and welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name is Christopher Brown. Today, what I want to talk to you about is horror comics, a little bit about where they possibly came from, more moving forward in terms of their popularity and their influence today. Comics generally influence a lot of media, I think we'll find it. From the anime influences of The Matrix, which led in to a lot of influence generally in sci-fi and action cinema, through to things like The Walking Dead. And also, you know, the Walking Dead, of feeding back from George A. Romero's own influences on him as a child, the EC comic books, which led to, you know, some of the cartoony elements of films like Dawn of the Dead, but also, you know, probably most typified by Creepshow, his ode to the comics that he grew up with.
Coming soon. Jolting tales of horror. Creepshow. From the author of Carrie, The Shining, and Cujo. And the creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. You'll scream at ghastly ghouls. Cringe at weird kids. And shiver at the doings of evil doctors.
This is going to be extremely painful, Mr. Verrill.
Creepshow will grab you, grow on you, and give you the creeps.
No, this is going to be an entirely new experience.
Creepshow, the most fun you'll ever have being scared.
So, the films themselves. So, let's start right at the beginning. And the idea of obviously drawing horror in a narrative format is nothing new. It was nothing new in the 40s and 50s either. If we look at the 12th century, you know, in the Heian period, there's the Gaki Joshi, which is basically the scroll of hungry ghosts. Now, a hungry ghost effectively is a spirit that is powered so much by terrible events that they're more than just a ghost or an echo of somebody. They're forceful and aggressive. And in the 16th century, the Mixtec codices again had similar, you know, was narrative storytelling. Pulp fiction, unsurprisingly, when we get to the 20th century, you know, the increase in mass-produced word and cheap word is a lot bigger. So really, though, when we talk about these things, we have to look at it, you know, from at a starting point from the 1930s and 1940s. And a genre I haven't really spoken about it's more known for the lurid covers than they are possibly for the content, but weird menace. Now, weird menace is a subgenre. It's something that we all see and we all know. Really, we identify it when we know it, when we see it. You know, a film like Blood Feast contains weird menace elements. These are, you know, sadistic baddies who graphically torture and kill people. You know, it's effectively a very extreme type of person, the type that would, you know, drink your blood and tie your girlfriend to a wooden slab or something, you know. And in the early 30s, comic books pulp books like Dragnet or Dime Detective used to kind of air towards these kind of storytelling elements, probably because they're salacious in truth. In 1933, Dime Mystery kind of came out as a comic book that focuses on this kind of stuff very, very clearly. And they were spotted by these magazines were spotted in the papers as being, you know, a bad thing. So, for example, the American Mercury published in 1938 an account on these terror magazines. This month, as every month, the 1,508,000 copies of terror magazines, known to the trade as the Shudder Group, will be sold throughout the nation. They will contain enough illustrated sex perversion to give Kraft Ebbing the unholy jitters. Now, that's a random reference. But that what we're talking about is Richard von Kraft Ebbing, who is known for his work in psychopath sexuals and such like. So, yeah. So these dime mystery magazines have contained a lot of, you know, of illustrated work. I suppose you could say were influenced by Grand Journal, but they were pulp fiction. You know, they were designed to titillate, I think, a little bit. Now, most of these stories usually kind of focused on the rational, although there were occasional, you know, resolutions that it was actually supernatural, which in truth could have been a bit more lazy writing than anything more than that. And as that kind of horror element, you know, became more standardized and also popular, they began to influence the superhero comic books and those stories as well. It makes sense that if you have, you know, a superhero fighting crime, that they would fight vampires and ghouls and mad scientists as well, particularly because in the 1930s the influence of universal horror was leaking out. So you had films that were popular with horror elements, but also magazines that showed that there was a market for it. In 1939, National Periodicals published a story by Jerry Siegel, the creator of Superman, called Doctor Occult in New Fun Comics number 6. Now, Doctor Occult confronts a vampire master, and in the same year, in Detective Comics, we've got Batman, you know, vampire for the first time. And these kind of ideas grew. In the mid-1940s, you know, these crime comics had incorporated elements of horror within their graphics and design, and that featured more literary versions of these kind of stories. So you've got an Edgar Allan Poe sitting in there amongst all the other stuff. This reflects the growth also on old-time radio shows that were using elements of this kind of stuff. So, you know, there was, you know, The Witch's Tale or The Hermit's Cave or Suspense, which them themselves featured horrible stories to be played a little bit later at night. Harvey Comics in 1945 did an anthology called Front Page Comic Book, and on its cover had a knife-wielding ghoul. In 1946, in July, there was a comic called Strange Story, which introduced Bob Powell's character, the Man in Black, the first elements of a character that kind of overseed the horror that went on in comic book form, replicating things like, as we said, Suspense and The Whistler. Indeed, the Man in Black becomes a character on radio himself. And to this day, there are occasional UK versions of the Man in Black telling ghost stories. Introduce them, anyway. The horror comic initially is embedded in pulp magazines, and where it would be perfectly normal for young women to be attacked and assaulted in them by maniacs who, you know, meant to be saved, you know, they need to be saved from them. Now, in December 1940, Prize Comics introduces a 8-page version or update of Frankenstein called The New Adventures of Frankenstein. It was more of a rejig of the original story than anything that actually was too iffy and or too modernized or different. This is seen as the industry's first run at ongoing comic tales, so a story that kind of goes through a number of issues. And it's seen as the first ongoing comic book series to basically slam straight into what we would call traditional horror. It's a, you know, it, before, you know, the like a lot of pulp in that time, and, you know, a lot, maybe, you know, something you can look at with, you know, German crime in the 40s as well. It's more like a pulp element of a story. A pulp element of a story rather than just an extreme crime drama. Like a Seven, for example, if you're looking at modern examples, rather than something more supernatural, more horror orientated. Now, the idea of an actual horror comic that's a complete and all horror doesn't really happen until 1943. Classic Comics, in June of that year, adapted Washington Irving's short story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, some reason trying to mix it as like a, well, it's the comic book has Rip Van Winkle and as a story, and then the Headless Horseman. And then in the next issue, they adapt all of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and then that's just the entire comic. So effectively, that's the first one in August 1943. Although that's obviously a literary adaptation, Avon Publications steps it up to something a bit different. Eerie in 1947, but obviously dated. Actually, yeah, I need to explain that. With magazines and comics generally, if when I say August of that year, it's normally actually released a little earlier than that. So, for example, you know, Christmas specials might actually have a February date on, but if they haven't come in late, they're being sold before then. But that was seen as an out-and-out horror comic. You know, you've got a fiend, kind of looks a bit like a Nosferatu kind of character with red eyes and long nails. He looks a bit like the key vampire in Salem's Lot, if you remember that. And there's a woman in a red dress tied to a pillar as well, just to really kind of ramp up the sleaze factor. But the book itself had 6 comic stories in it and features zombies and ghosts and stuff like that. So it was very much part of that story. And it very much feels like a comic. And certainly the kind of things that we'll be talking about moving forward here. Adventures into the Unknown, which ran from 1948 to 1967, was an ongoing horror comic which featured stories of ghosts and werewolves and haunted houses and killer puppets and that kind of thing. At that point, horror comics kind of, well, they've not really had a foothold in truth. There's the pulp stuff, but it's hardly, you know, amazingly awesome. But the popularity kind of shifts generally to crime, and then romance novels as well, which in the late 40s actually outsold other genres. Now, in this late 40s, EC steps in and produces his first horror story, Zombie Terror, by an unknown writer and artist called Johnny Craig, in the superhero comics Moon Girl. Transworld Publication issues a one-shot publication in 1948 as well, called The Mysterious Traveller, which was a reprint of The Telltale Heart. After that, and the success of those kind of comics, we really start to see a flood of stuff. Atlas Comics, which was a forerunner of Marvel, really ramped up this. See, 1940s superhero stories, there'd been elements, as we said, of these kind of horror tales that kind of webbed through. So zombies and vampires would pop up, and, you know, the Japanese might be, or the Nazis might be kind of creating something in a lab for Superman to sort out, or Batman to solve. But in 1949, Atlas actually kind of stepped in with Amazing Mysteries 32, which felt far more like a horror series. And indeed, Atlas move away from comic book series to horror, but they kind of just changed the name of the stuff. So comics like Marvel Mystery Comics just kind of flip into horror series, and rather than kind of, you know, change name or try and restart a new franchise. So Captain America's Weird Tales 74-75 didn't actually contain Captain America at all. And Harvey Comics follow suit. Their costume crime fighter, the Black Cat, becomes a horror comic called The Black Cat Mysteries, which barely features the Black Cat, if at all. So from here up to late 1954, horror comics are all over the show. They are big deal, influential. This is the key element in terms of when we talk about things like Creepshow. So you've got, in that period, there are 91 issues of EC Comics through three different series: The Haunt of Fear, The Vault of Horror, and The Crypt of Terror, which was then named Tales from the Crypt, as we'll know from anyone who remembers the TV series. That's what it was based on. A publisher had inherited this comic line called Educational Comics. It was a guy called William Gaines, and when his father died, he was given the business. 3 years later, Gaines and his editor introduced horror in two of the company's crime comics to see how they go. They were successful. And then they turned the business effectively into a horror-run business. So that Moon Girl line, which at the time was a romance, become morphs into Weird Fantasy, which is another sci-fi, heavy sci-fi line. So for those 4 years, The Old Witch, The Vault Keeper, and The Crypt Keeper introduced stories from people who were going to be top artists in the field, such as Jack Davis and Graham Ingalls. The comics are known mainly for their twist endings, their grisly tone and images, and also the idea of a poetic justice. You know, it adores the concept that people will get their just desserts. These stories are influential, particularly in the portmanteau films of the 1970s, and obviously Creepshow as well. But generally, with like, you know, the more cartoony elements in washed out horror, you know, these days obviously we don't see much horror with dazzling reds and blues, but in the 70s it was all over the show and a big deal, you know. Now, as we already said, in the 1940s, there were already concerns about these comic books, particularly the crime stories, by the public, that thought that the content of them would, you know, affect and be harmful to children. And there was an increase in juvenile delinquency at the time, and that was seen as an element to it, that it would be, you know, the comic books had broken these people. So publications were actually started to be banned anyway. Although that was actually overturned. The US Supreme Court in 1948 overruled a New York law that banned pictures and stories of deeds of bloodshed, lust, or crime as unconstitutional to the freedom of speech. However, the problem was that there was still outcry. And there were a number of publications were written that kind of warned of the dangers of this stuff. There was an article, Horror in the Nursery, by journalist Judith Crist in 1948 in Collier's Weekly. And an issue in the Saturday Review of Literature in the same year, which both said that, which came from information from a symposium of psychologists where somebody stood up and suggested that comic books were abnormally sexually aggressive and therefore led to crime. The Association of Comic Magazine Publishers, a trade industry body, was set up in an attempt to create some kind of self-regulation before there were more problems that came forward. However, this was a fairly ineffective term, as most publishers did not want to join it because they thought that it wasn't going to be much use to them. So it didn't work. I suppose we need to talk about The Seduction of the Innocents. This is 1947 by Dr. Frederick Wharton. It was a main driver to the concept that crime was caused by comic books, effectively. This, what I would argue, slightly unscientific journal, which used anecdotal evidence, suggested that violent comic books encouraged violent behaviour. It's a story we still see now, isn't it? That, you know, like computer games can lead to bad behaviour and that kind of thing. Wharton was very concerned about the fact that there were sexual elements in terms of these books, you know, where women were curvaceous and there was a focus on nudity. Some of the boys he'd interviewed actually said they used it to masturbate to. And one guy said, lad said he wants to be a sex maniac. And indeed, you know, there was the sexualized images of women tied up were there to titillate, so it's not that surprising. Wharton basically said, though, that kids were kind of hiding this from their parents. Well, probably, obviously, you're going to hide masturbating from your parents, aren't you? But that they were kind of reading, you know, Superman or kids' comics when they're not looking, when the parents were there, and then kind of whipping out these horror comics that they found, you know, when the parents were out the room. He concluded with a kind of a variety, you know, a variety of things that had been released, and included in actual fact a story called, from someone called Foul Play, which was an EC story for, about a baseball player whose head and intestines were used by his teammates in a game. The contents of the magazine, of this report, unsurprisingly called mayhem. You know, your tits are being duplicious, being sexually affected by these comic books that they can easily acquire, and these comic books are, you know, absolutely repulsive in terms of their content. Look at this. And of course, it's a heady, sex and violence is always a heady mix anyway, particularly when you're talking about young minds. In 1954, all this mixture of public concern and, in truth, comic books continually pushing the line as much as they could, it led to a Senate Committee on Juvenile Delinquency. Dr. Wharton actually said he insisted that he appeared before the committee, presenting a long list of his credentials. Wharton, who was you know, German, actually suggested that horror comics were similar to the kind of propaganda that Hitler had used in Nazi Germany to sway the public. And indeed, you know, William Gaines stands up as part of the EC and desperately tries to defend his business. And he was kind of, I said that he was responsible for it. He thought that was fine. He was unrepentant, and in an area where they kind of wanted him to be at least kind of repentant, the committee filed a report. Although we're not particularly ready to stand by the comics. Now, they refused to pin any blame on crime on comic books. They didn't see any evidence of that. However, they were not willing to let it go, and insisted that at least recommended quite heavily that the comic book industry decide to tone down some of their content under their own volition. In 1953, a quarter of all comic books were horror titles. So the Comics Code of America was formed, and many of the stipulations made it very difficult for horror comics to continue at all. Because if you couldn't stick to the guidelines, you wouldn't find any distribution for your product. So anything from detail and methods of crime, scenes of violence, torture, unsurprisingly, excessive and unnecessary knife and gunplay, people in pain, gore, anything gruesome, basically. All of that was taken off, and there was this huge list of what classed as depraved, of what's too lustful, too sadistic or masochistic. because of these congressional hearings and indeed the code, DC completely shifts focus. So House of Mystery, House of Secrets, all those kind of what were horror novels shift into kind of sci-fi, strange tales territory. And indeed, Marvel does a similar kind of thing with Strange Tales and Journey into Mystery. Some of the comic book sellers didn't actually sign up to the code, but were able to kind of get away with it because they had a reputation as being kind of wholesome comic books anyway. You know, they weren't pictured that kind of people. And they were kind of able to kind of sell their products away from the code. But and they were still horror, but they weren't as gruesome. So they did things like Twilight Zone as a licensed cash-in in 1961. They did a version of Dracula in 62. But they kept it relatively toned down. Boris Karloff's Tales of Mystery, what was Boris Karloff's thriller back in the day, all kind of had the similar kind of thing. And then, you know, you could say, you know, the Gold Key in 65 had the Addams Family and the Munsters. So, and then Ripley's Believe It or Not, to give you some kind of feel of the tone or the level of this kind of stuff. It was a million miles away from EC. And even things like, you know, True Ghost Stories certainly kind of went towards a more general feeling of ghostiness rather than anything that's more macabre. Another way to kind of get around this kind of stuff was through eerie publications, which was kind of a bit second tier, low rent, or kind of, you know, a bit cheaper, if I'm being honest. But they removed themselves from the comics industry and created horror magazines, printed in black and white. And they kind of took some new stuff and some reprints from some previous comic code stuff, mainly Weird and stuff like that. And I kind of said, sold it as, you know, we're not actually a horror comic. You know, we're something different. We're a magazine. They followed then a resurgence, like a number of supernatural mysteries kind of stuff. Charlton Comics released things like Ghostly Tales and stuff like that. And at DC Comics, the House of Mystery kind of edited some kind of horror roots, you know, as with a lot of this kind of stuff, you know, as time goes on, people kind of push the boundaries a little bit. And indeed, by 1971, the Code Authority had relaxed its rules on horror comics, which opened the possibilities that they could actually, you know, do some more of the stuff that they wanted to do. So, like, you know, things like, you know, you still can't torture people, but you can have ghouls and werewolves and vampires and, you know, as long as they feel more like an Edgar Allan, you know, basically, make it like Dracula. Don't make it like, I don't know, 30 Days a Night or something like that, as it would be now. So Marvel went, yeah, all right, brilliant, let's do it. They introduced Morbius into the Living Vampire, then Dracula and Tomb of Dracula, and then kind of did a lot. So you've got, suddenly the comics books kind of change in tone. You get things like Ghost Rider and like Son of Satan. And a lot of these comics are certainly, you know, they feel they have their 70s feel to them. They have that tone. You can definitely see a jump in terms of what's permitted. And so, and they make the most of that. DC run a number of horror titles too, including things like Swamp Thing and Weird War Tales, Tales of Ghost Castle and that kind of stuff. But by the mid-70s, people's taste for that had also diminished. And really, again, as with a lot of this stuff, you get only a few, after the market being swamped with different titles, there's only a few really continue. So in the 80s, a number of comics were created that kind of, well, from an independent point of view, and also from a populist point of view, kind of continued the horror franchise. Most notably, Wes Craven created a film version of Swamp Thing in 1982. By 1984, Alan Moore had been brought on to kind of continue to revamp that revised series. Moore actually did a lot of work to that series to kind of change it, including making Swamp Thing an actual monster rather than a man turned into a monster. And, I mean, you know, the Swamp Thing film is an unusual thing, but the comic line really grew.
government agents, scientists, soldiers, master criminals, secret formulas, monsters, and midgets. None of them belong in this swamp. Only one thing does. The Swamp Thing.
Uh-huh. Here comes trouble.
The Swamp Thing.
There goes the neighborhood.
Adrienne Barbeau and the Swamp Thing, an outrageous pair in the incredible adventure that grows on you or all over you. The Adventures of the Swamp Thing. The comic book legend lives.
And if actual fact, by 1988, it had created the spin-off Hellblazer, which is, as we know now from TV shows and the film, the John Constantine story of a demon killer who is already tied to hell. DC introduced the Vertigo line to kind of keep these kind of more mature comics away from its core product. So you got Hellblazer and Swamp Thing, and obviously Neil Gaiman's Sandman as well. And there's revamps and relaunches as well in terms of, you know, Marvel do, you know, bring reviving Ghost Rider and things like that in the mid 90s. And to this day, well, we see a variety of horror comics that sit through, don't we? Obviously, Walking Dead's been mentioned numerous times here. Steve Nye's 30 Days of Night, which created a few different spin-off comic books and also a film now as well. Hellboy, again, films with it. Blade in the noughties. And, you know, things like Silent Hill spin-off comic books and Resident Evil comic books, you know, as well from those TV shows. I mean, some of the Silent Hill stuff in the mid-noughties was very good. And of course, you know, things like Raise the Dead by Liam Moore and John Repian. You know, there's lots of this kind of stuff that just sits casually, particularly in the in the independent sector and strands like IDW, but also, you know, DC and Marvel as well, creating their own versions of horror. It would be remiss to miss out on the influences of in other parts of the world too as well. That story of comic books right there is very much a US focused one. When we look to Japan though, I mean, there's tons there. Horror comics started appearing in the late 50s, early 60s, and kind of sat really in the mainstream pretty much from there. A lot of the time, the horror comic in Japan sat within magazines like a lot of these kind of, you know, ongoing periodicals. But there was also horror manga as well in terms of more book form. In the 1970s, Hideyoshi Hino created a lot of stories for Garo, which was an alternative magazine. And then you've got people like Shihiro Maruro, who very much built a legacy on creating horror comics that were very gory indeed. Maru's illustration style basically features graphic sex and violence, certainly not the kind of thing you get past the comic book code, you know. And fit within some called eroguro, so erotic grotesque. So there'd be deformities and circus freaks intermingled with this story. If you want to see some of this work, which I do recommend because it is very unusual, The Strange Tale of Panorama Island was published in July of 2013. You should be able to pick up a copy for, I don't know, about 20 quid somewhere if you look on eBay or on Amazon. And it really mixes this kind of beautiful classic style with incredible amounts of violence. And it is a good introduction to this very strange kind of work. Over in the UK, we have, horror comics or comics generally tended to be reprints of American Fare. But, you know, in the early 1970s, there was things like Shiver and Shake and Monster Fun as well, which aimed more at younger people. And then there's, in the late 70s and early 80s, there's things like Scream and Misty, both of which are very much, but boys and girls really, but both are kind of ghostly and horror related. And then, you know, from the mid 90s, really the big play was still only 2000 AD, as we all know, which kind of mixes kind of sci-fi with horror quite frequently. And then you've got things like, you know, it's got horror, pure horror elements and quite monstrous elements as well, with things like, through those stories as well. Very much featuring a kind of a traditionalist agenda in it. The London Horror Comic is an occasional issue-driven product, which you still get now, which ships around the world and is an anthology horror. So you get things like, a mix of stories, in truth, using writers from the UK. So they've only had 7 issues, effectively, as being an anthology. They're celebrating 10 years at the moment, for running to 2016, so that they are still very much ongoing and creating some very beautiful work as well. So the horror comic book kind of sits within a steady and great stream of love for genre, and it introduces concepts or revives concepts and keeps concepts going that we've spoken about before, The horror host, and we spoke about in Midnight Movies, and the anthology of horror. Indeed, we already spoke about when we were talking about the influence of comic books on the Santa slasher genre. It's unsurprising that a medium which is based on creating a lot of content, horror content, is able to touch on a variety of genres and come up with ideas and actually, be a part of that process. And, the reality of this is when we're talking about Walking Dead, Walking Dead was a comic book series, obviously influenced by Romero, who was influenced by EC, but now is, this huge TV program which is in its 7th series at the moment. And there's a rich vein of storytelling, in a very, we talk about, the way attitudes have changed, but, as a TV program, it's incredibly violent. And I think that's interesting in itself.
Put the gun down!
Go!
Rick! He's here!
You even know what's going on?
I woke up in the hospital. That's all I know.
I was saying on the news some kind of virus.
Man, you won't believe the panic.
Lori! Carl!
You know about the dead people, right? The walkers.
My wife and son, they're alive.
If they got out of here, they're in Atlanta.
Why there?
Military protection, shelter, food.
Atlanta sounds like a good deal.
Broadcasting on emergency band. We'll be approaching Atlanta on Highway 85. Anyone hear me? Please respond.
Loneliness.
Hello, can anybody hear my voice?
Hey, hello? We're just outside the city. Hello? Damn it.
We ought to warn people away from the city.
Folks got no idea what they're getting into.
All I am anymore is a man looking for his wife and son. Anybody gets in the way, that's gonna lose. Sorry this happened to you. I can't go on.
Anyway, hopefully you enjoyed that. Thanks very much for listening. If you want to get a hold of me, please do. My email address is christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com. Get me on Twitter @orange_monkey, or you can go to the website, thelasthorrorpodcast.com, and there's articles and things like that as well. Bit of housekeeping as well. Last week I moved the streams for History of Horror and Video Nasties podcasts to my hosting. Originally, they were on the, for people who listen to it, the Strange and Deadly Gentleman's Grindhouse hosting. It was sitting over on their stuff hidden away. Moved it over onto my own. So the URLs will still be the same, but currently the links may or may not work, depending on how long the website's got to go. But if you're on the podcatcher, they'll all work fine and you should be able to get the episodes. If you're one of the people who are subscribed to them and suddenly found your podcatcher was epically downloading all the content again, apologies for that. When you move stuff over, you've got to build the stream again fresh. So it's basically considered all that to be fresh content. So my apologies. Last thing, if you want to get a mixtape from me, I think again we'll kind of go 1950s this month, because you know, considering we're talking about the 50s and ghosts and ghouls and monsters, then you can do, if you go to the website, go to mixtapes and just fill in the little form there. I will send you a weekly email, just a link to the podcast and through for a couple of lines or something like that, depending on if there's anything extra I want to mention, and a link to a Spotify playlist as well, of just some tunes you can listen to after this, which should hopefully, fingers crossed, tie in with the podcast. I'm trying to get better at that, if I'm being honest. Thanks very much for listening. Next week we're going to talk about Edward, notorious, did some horror, did some porn, a fascinating character. I think the Tim Burton film kind of made an impact on how people see this stuff and his work and kind of how they perceive him. So we're going to try and dial back away from that portrayal and really try and tell the story of Edward. So until then, take care and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.